Well, I'd like to welcome you to this session entitled Not Knowing Enough or Knowing Enough to Know That We Don't Know Enough. Okay. And our presenter is Lowell, known as Lou at Le Masani. And Lou is a certified financial planner, but if you notice in your handout, he's also a farmer, rancher, scientist, soldier, businessman, lay minister, student of psychology, I guess all-around Leonardo genius kind of person.
Yeah, well,
this presentation is grounded in the work of Ken Wilber, and it's potential interface with Mormonism, and I've spent many years as a fan both of Ken Wilber's work and of Mormonism as a member of the church myself. So really thrilled to have him do this presentation. And when Lou is finished, Alan Lambert will be the respondent. And I'll just go ahead and introduce Alan now, and you can just get up and appreciate if each of you could say a little bit more about yourselves as well. But Alan is a sociologist, academic, and businessman, and we'll have him introduce a little bit more about his background and why he's fascinated in being a respondent for this particular session as well. Lou.
For those of you who showed up looking for the Mormon nudist presentation, you're in the wrong place. You're going to be disappointed. But then you'd be more disappointed if this was the Mormon nudist. There's not a whole lot more to say about me that isn't going to scare you to death. I guess you could call me a Suf, not a Sufi, but a Suf. A Suf is one who struggles to know God personally through suffering and through effort. I feel for Alan today. He's had a rough day. He was a respondent earlier for a gentleman who gave him 70 pages of information to use as background for his talk. Then he got my stuff, a little scruffy outline and a copy of my few PowerPoint slides, and he was wondering what I was going to do for the next 40 minutes. And so we'll see how he responds to the challenge, but I think he's up to it. Well, wouldn't be surprised. I'm a Jungian by interest as well. Very much a follower of Carl Jung. I think he would shudder at the word Jungian, but we'll use it anyway. And because I'm a Jungian, I had a dialogue with my psyche before I began this talk. It's something that I love to do. And the dialogue started out with me posing to the psyche, "Why don't you do this talk?" And the psyche came back and said, "If you think that gets you out of preparing material, you're stupider than I thought you were." The next thing he said, or I said to the psyche, was, "Well, why don't you just be in charge, and I'll listen and say what you want to say." And he said, "You're going to put a part of your mind in charge that gives you these horrible, incredible, monstrous nightmares, and let me present a class. I'd be glad to do it." So I backed off from that proposal. I went to the psyche again and said, "Well, why don't you whisper in my ear or put a little image in front of my eyes if there's something you want me to say?" And the psyche said, "Look, we've been doing this for 20 years and you can't keep up. But we're going to try that approach anyway and see how it works." So that's the arrangement we're going to use. I hope you'll stay simple. And speaking of simple, let's look at a simple symbol, the next slide on our presentation. And let's play a little game here. You see the question at the top of the slide. By the way, this particular symbol and question comes from the 12 and 13-year-old Sunday school manual of the church. So this is very non-controversial stuff. Don't get upset. How many squares do you see? Anybody want to volunteer an answer? Don't be afraid. There's no wrong answers today. You can say three. I may look at you like, "What?" But go ahead. How many?
Zero.
Okay. There's one answer I didn't expect. Okay, we'll take that. 20? The slide's a little out of proportion. I apologize. It's supposed to be squares. Let me bring that. I didn't notice that. 23, 24. How many of you see 16? 16. How many of you see 17? How many of you see more? Well, 16 is pretty easy, right? 4 by 4, that's 16. 17 is pretty easy because if this slide was in proportion, something always goes wrong. The trickster is always present in Jungian presentations. The outside square would obviously be the 17th square. There are other squares there that you can look at. If you look here, there's a 2 by 2 square in that corner, one in that corner, one down here in this corner, and one over here in this corner. There's four more. There's a 2 by 2 square at the top middle, bottom middle, right side, left side, and there's a 2 by 2 square right there. That's 9 2 by 2 squares. Brings our total to 26. Is that it?
No.
What else?
3 by 3.
3 by 3, yes. Again, this would be a 3 by 3 square. We could shift over to this side, another one. Another one down here. Whoops, 3 by 3. And another one here, 3 by 3. So there's four more, bringing a total of 30 squares. Does that make sense? Are we all together on that? Is that it?
No.
No. Well, what other answers are there? What other squares do you see? Oh, maybe the question isn't how many squares are there as far as what we can see. How about what we could imagine? If we look at that and we start to imagine the possibility of other squares, we could come up with how many? And an infinite number of squares. We could draw all different sizes. This shirt was no accident, by the way, today. We could draw all different arrangements of squares. We could start in a tiny dot and square in the middle. We could get into microscopic squares. You know the story. We could go all the way. Well, let's talk about our perception of this particular little mathematics geometry puzzle here. If we just saw 16, we might consider ourselves someone who's not initiated into geometry. And we just know math and we can count to 16, we can see 4 by 4. And it's kind of a basic, who cares, there's 16, shut up, leave me alone. If we go higher, up to maybe 30, this is somebody that may be more involved in the discipline of mathematics, a little more enlightened, schooled, a little more understanding. And they can see deeper into the situation. If we say there's an infinite number of squares there, we have taken a big step. We have gone from the concept of counting what we can count as an educated mathematician might do to someone who's taking an imaginative approach, a what-if approach, a mind-of-the-creator approach. What if the creator of this puzzle didn't draw all the squares in there that could possibly be drawn? So we can. It depends on our perspective and the way we look at things. Well, let's go to another slide, and let's talk about perspective and the way we look at things on the standpoint of how we look at Scripture. This is Matthew 22, 37 and 38, or a portion of it anyway. And it's saying, "Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment." Sounds pretty important. Maybe we ought to look at this. We again could take a look at this. And anybody here watch Family Feud back in the days when it's still on reviews and cable? Anybody watch that show? You know how it works? There's the most popular answer, and then there's the next answer. And they make like three or four answers that are correct. And you got to get those three or four answers before you get knocked out with three X's. Let's look at this from the standpoint of the most popular answers. The most popular answer probably would be that of someone who is not initiated into Christianity or Scripture. Their response might be, love who and why and goodbye. You know, I don't care about this. I don't know who this guy is. Why should I love him? Most popular answer. Second most popular answer might be what we could call maybe the literal answer. Lou, it's telling us what it says. It says, love the Lord with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. There it is. It's pretty simple. What's wrong with you? Is it that hard? Then we could get into the number three answer, but I'm going to skip it and go to number four. And number four is the deeply psychologically disturbed answer, which says, all thy heart and all thy soul and all thy mind. Here is something I can really obsess on. Okay? I can really get involved to the point of near insanity on this particular commandment. Just get out there. The third most popular answer is the New Age answer. The reason I didn't give it, it's really not intelligible. I don't know what they say. Somebody like that, I'm sorry. No, I'm not sorry. We won't say anything more about that. Let's move ahead. Let's draw some parallels with this particular commandment, which is a New Testament commandment. So maybe it's lost some influence. Maybe it's not as important now as it was then. Let's look at the next. Modern scripture. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy might, mind, and strength. This commandment is especially applicable to the saints in Zion. Especially applicable to the saints in Zion. If we're going to establish a Zion society, once again, this sounds pretty darned important. Is it the same as the previous verse? Is it almost the same? The other one said something about heart and strength and soul, did it not? Or heart and mind and soul. So instead of heart, mind, and soul, instead of soul, we have might and strength. Okay, we're in a Mormon Sunday school class. What is the soul made of? Two parts.
Body and spirit.
Body and spirit. Well, here the words are might and strength. Sounds the same to me, doesn't it? Might and strength. That sounds like body and body. You agree?
Yeah.
Sounds that way. I agree. If you look in the scriptures under the word strength, you will find a number of scriptures, all referring to something like this. The Lord is my strength. God is my strength. So it's possible in this particular verse that what strength refers to is the spiritual aspect, the divine aspect, the godliness aspect. What that is our real strength as believers in Christ, as believers in God. Might, then, is our own physical might, our own body. So if we read it with that in mind, then we would say, with our hearts, with our minds, with our bodies, and with our spirit, with our strength, the Spirit of the Lord, what the Lord gives us, what is divine in us. Again, a very important commandment. Let's go to the Old Testament. When we go to the Old Testament, God gets weird. I mean, he gets kind of crazy, even gets mean. One of the things that's always interested me as a Jungian is you can tell a lot more about a person who's writing something, who's saying something, than you can about the person they may be writing about or the object that they may be considering. So I always look at the Old Testament and say, is it really God that's so mean and so violent and so difficult here? Or is it those that are writing about him? That's how they perceive God, because it's what's in their own minds and hearts. I'll leave that with you as a question to consider, but that's how we're going to approach that in this particular situation. This is more those who write about him and how they perceive him. But let's go to Ezekiel. And in chapter 1, verse 1, this particular vision starts out and mentions that he saw visions of God. Let's go to the next verse. And out of the midst thereof came four living creatures. They had the likeness of a man. We'll be coming back to that. But let's go to the next verse. Everyone has four faces. So every one of these men, these likenesses, had four faces. Well, I've been accused of being two-faced before, but never four-faced. This is kind of interesting. Let's go back to that first slide. Four faces, four creatures, a 4x4. And you thought I was just doing this to introduce you to the idea of thinking differently? We're really looking here at possibly a diagram that in some rudimentary way is indicative of the mind of God. Now, I'm not going to go too deeply on that today because I don't have 3 hours to discuss it. But keep that thought in mind. Also, for you ladies, this is the man version of the mind of God. It's nice little boxes, okay? Kind of like a waffle. We're going to look at the woman version of God's mind as we go. In fact, I prefer that, as you'll see as we finish up our presentation. But keep that in mind. Now let's go back to Ezekiel. And go to the last verse here. And these four faces had the face of a man, the face of a lion, and the face of an ox, and the face of an eagle. Now let's consider the symbolism of those four symbols. Let's be real simple here today. We could spend an hour on each of these symbols and talk about the depth of all the meaning that there is there, and I think that's one of the wonderful things to do with Scripture. But I'm going to summarize some of my thoughts and lead you down a path. You can follow, you can resist, you can take a nap, but we will stay with it. The lion, a symbol of pride, courage, dignity, valor, a very emotional, passionate animal, something that might be indicative of the heart. An ox, the worker, he's strong, he can pull the plow. His function is to use his body to accomplish things, to do the work. Again, a sign of body or of might. Man distinguishes himself by being a thinker, someone who reasons, someone who thinks things through. Sometimes not too well, but he thinks things through. He has that capacity above and beyond God's other creations, as far as we understand. And then we have the eagle. The eagle is a very curious animal. It soars extremely high, up into the heavens. It can see underwater. It can see fish in the ocean or in the streams. It can see a mouse in a field running under the grass because it can see the heat, infrared light waves coming from the mouse. So the eagle is extremely discerning. It comes from the heavens to the earth and back. A very spiritual animal. Let's go to the next slide, I think. Yes. So now we have brought Ezekiel chapter 1 into here, and using those four symbols, we could draw some parallels. Lion to the heart, the might to the ox, man to the mind, and the eagle to strength or spirituality. Questions at this point? Are we doing okay? Let's go ahead and introduce another gentleman who in his study came up with what he called the four functions of the mind. This is Carl Jung. Carl said that there are four things that our mind can do, basically. We can feel, we can have sensation, we can record, as our mind can record sensation, we can think, and we can intuit. Feeling, for Carl Jung, basically equates to emotion, okay, to the heart. Anciently, the heart was also the seat of wisdom, and Jung draws some parallels there, but we're going to stick a little more with the feeling, emotion side of things there. Sensation. Sensation is your mind's capacity to feel and to note what's happening with your body. Sit back for a moment, close your eyes, and observe how you're breathing. Are you relaxed? Can you feel your body breathing in and out? Sensation allows you to feel exertion. There are people who have that dominant mode of using their mind. These are people who are athletes, who do a lot of active things. They may be skiing and doing all kinds of active things like that in the winter, and doing running and Ironman triathlons and so forth in the summertime. A sensator is someone who really gets a lot of satisfaction from the feeling of physical effort, from feeling their body do things of that type. The thinking person, okay, is one who is using their mind primarily for logic, reason, and so forth. The intuitive is someone who then is more spiritual, who brings in that aspect of being able to sense outside influences or influences higher than their own mind, whether it is spirit, whether it is inspiration, whether it is someone else's feelings, so forth. An intuitive person functions that way. Now, I'm sure as you look at that list, you can say to yourself, I know people who are all of those types. Okay? And Carl Jung's position was that typically we have one or two dominant types of mental function, that is, what we have mastered. Typically, academicians will be the thinking type. That'll be their strength, their ability to be rational, to deduct, to use deductive reasoning, to take things apart, to analyze, you know, does this make sense to me? Does this have any validity to me in the structure that I use? Someone who can follow a path of logic. Certainly, the Western psyche is dominated by the thinking types. We have been tremendous in our development of logic and reason. I hear some derogative remarks made about that in Sunstone and other places. We have gone so far by developing that side of our minds. It has been such a blessing to us. There is no problem in my mind with the ability to think and to reason and to be rational. The problem is, oftentimes, we don't develop the other areas. And this is what Carl Jung says. He says, if we are dominant and if we are extremely able in one area, typically there are one or two areas then where we are not developed very well at all. I could ask the ladies in the audience if their thinking husband is really adept at being and feeling emotion, love, connection, empathy. Hopefully, several of you would say yes. But probably some of you would say, are you kidding me? Okay, and oftentimes if we were to reverse the tables and say to the man, is your wife good at feeling, at loving, at emotion, at nurturing, at those feeling functions, and sometimes not the best at logic and reasoning and so forth, we would probably get the same mix of answers. Some yes, but a lot probably not. Well, Carl Jung's premise is that we need to achieve balance. We need to achieve abilities in all of these areas. Carl Jung also discovered, or at least talked a lot about, the psyche. I don't know if he discovered that. I'll take it back, Alan. I didn't say it. Okay. but he talks a lot about the psyche. And he says it is basically the mission of the psyche to teach us how to become balanced, to guide us, to move us toward this balanced mind. And this balanced mind, to me, parallels the great commandment, the commandment for establishing Zion. Not only do we love the Lord with our heart, might, mind, and strength, but we learn to love Him with a mind, a brain, that is balanced and functioning and working in all of these areas, and it's our psyche that leads us there. Now, I'm going to throw out a scary subject, and we're going to go way off in left field as far as church doctrine goes, but why not? A premise. The psyche that Carl Jung talks about is the unconscious part of our mind. It's not unconscious. They're not conscious to us. We don't have access to it consciously. Does that have any parallels in Mormon doctrine? Is there any part of our mind that we believe in Mormon doctrine that we do not have access to? And what do we call that part? How about the veiled mind? The part that doesn't come with us to the earth as far as having access to it. It's veiled. Our experiences in the pre-existence, our understanding of God, which may be darn well near a perfect understanding, is shut off for some various obvious reasons. Carl Jung says that if we are careful in our preparation and thoughtful in our preparation, we can access this unconscious mind and get guidance from it. I'm saying that this unconscious mind may very well be the veiled mind. Now, am I going against church doctrine to say that the veiled mind can be accessed while we're on the earthly life? What did the Lord say about our body? Primary. Where's the primary teachers? Our body is a temple. And what are we taught in the temple? That if we go through certain ordinances, if we prepare ourselves, if we cleanse ourselves, if we take care of certain preparatory ways of thinking and committing ourselves in certain ways, we are brought to what? The veil. And we can knock on that veil and enter. Well, if our body is a temple, and the veiled part of our temple is our mind, can we prepare ourselves in a way to come to that veiled part of the mind and knock on it and ask to be admitted to have some access to what is behind there? I'll leave that thought with you, And let's take this one step further. Let's go to a gentleman by the name of Ken Wilber. Ken Wilber, in his books, talks about four waves. Kind of the four waves of being, you might say. He says we have to exercise these waves in our reality, and we'll talk about our reality in a moment. Those four waves are the emotional, physical, mental, and spiritual waves. Okay? Question. Do they have some parallels to what we've already talked about? You'd have to be about the zero grade level to not see those parallels. Obviously, they're there. The same things. Another premise that I will toss out. All great, honest seekers of truth will come to the same truth. What did Joseph Smith say about all truth shall be circumcised into one great whole? I think we can see some of that process, some allusion to that process in the thinking of these people and how they think. So Ken Wilber has some similar things to say that the scriptures say, some similar things to say that Carl Jung says. Ken goes a little further. Ken then says, how do we use those things? And he draws that out. Let's look at the next slide. Ken talks about reality, and he calls it spirituality. And he says there are four quadrants to reality. Let's look at the first. The first is what's called the interior left quadrant, which is about us, our internal motivations, the subjective part about us, what makes us tick. Number two, the it quadrant. This is also individual, but instead of talking about the inside personal side of it, it's looking at us as an object. How do we behave? What are the statistics? How many of us are voting for Osama? How many of us are stupid? No, wait a minute, I didn't say that. Was it Osama? Yeah, I meant Obama. Boy, there's a slip. And a very Freudian one. we won't get into that. Whatever the case may be, it talks about behavior. Who's doing what? What are they doing? How many percentage of people are doing this? So forth. That's scary. Let's go on to number three. Now we're talking about the social quadrant. We. What are our interior values? What is our culture value? What's important to us as a culture? The introspective side of things. The fourth quadrant. This is, again, the we quadrant, but now we're talking about plural objectivity. What are our social behaviors? How does our society behave? How do our institutions operate and behave? This is the interobjective side of us. Now, if you look at those for a little bit, I think you'll realize that once again, just as we had differences in the way we operate in Carl Jung's functions of mind, there are also differences in the way we operate with Ken Wilber's four quadrants of reality. He's saying that we have to operate in one of these quadrants, and that little center point where the lines cross is where we begin to develop our ability to be a part of this world, and that as we go out into all of these quadrants, we develop more fully and become more able to function in all four of these areas. Sometimes, especially in Western culture, we have a tendency to get too involved on the right-hand side of that quadrant. We get too involved with things and too involved with societies, governments, institutions, and so forth. We're all caught up in what do we have and what's everybody doing. That's kind of the thing. And we don't develop the left-hand side very well. What are our values? What's our personal motivations? Are we understanding ourselves well there? Are we comfortable with inspecting ourselves in those particular areas? A very big question. If we develop from the center and move out in a balanced way, it's kind of like the unfolding of a flower. If we just develop on one side of that, to me it's kind of like getting a tumor. You know, you just got this blob on one side of your ability to function in the world, and it doesn't develop well. Now, Ken gets pretty deep. Let's go with him to another slide and talk about this a little bit more. Here's the same four quadrants. Go ahead and hit the first one. Just hit them all. Bring up all four quadrants. There, thank you. And we have those same four quadrants, and inside of those quadrants, we have lines or levels of development. And if you look at the I quadrant, which is the upper left one at the development of the self, you'll see that it's down there. There's some of the lower levels are like magic or just getting in touch with the world. And we can move on up. I like number 5 in there somewhere, or it gets into, I guess, number 3, where it gets into egocentric. I know a lot of people that got stuck there. But the point is, one, not to find yourself on that chart. And number 2, not to get too caught up with moving up those levels on the chart. Ken Wilber says that it's important as individuals, as growing individuals and developing individuals, that we start and go through those lines of development. That if we're looking at the individual side of this, the I and the we, that we all have to deal with feeling the earth, finding the earth, becoming separated from the earth like a baby does. And then that we all have to go through kind of magic thinking. And we all get to a point where we're egocentric. Not only that, but we can be at different levels of development for different things. If I am a nuclear scientist, maybe my ability to have consciousness of what's going on in that particular area of my existence may be way up on the top of that scale somewhere. Especially on the right-hand inside, it may be way up there. We're talking about my ability to relate to my spouse, it may be back down lower in a different level. So we're all over that map in all the different areas of our life. The point is that we understand that it is a developmental sequence, number one, that we understand that there are quadrants in this developmental sequence that we can, as individuals, as we progress and grow, affect our culture and help it to grow, can affect our environment and help it to change. We can affect the institutions and the social part of our environment and help it to change as well. That we function in all 4 of these quadrants and can move along in various areas, and that we become as aware, as comfortable, and as able as we can in developing ourselves along those developmental lines. Don't get too Western culture and say, oh my God, I got to get busy and get to the top of each one of these 4 quadrants. No, it's more a matter of awareness. And if you want to know where to start and what to do first, consult your psyche. Your psyche will tell you which step to take first, and it's not going to rush you along. It's not going to have you try to skip developmental levels. It's not going to have you worry about what level you are compared to your neighbor or your friend or your bishop. It's going to have you work on what you need to work at, one step at a time. Okay, very carefully, very calmly. Are there questions on this concept at this point? Let me read just a couple thoughts from Ken Wilber and his explanation. He's very much more astute at this than I am. Wilber says, even if we possess the perfect integral map of the cosmos, a map that was completely all-inclusive and unerringly holistic, which is the top levels of this chart, okay, the map itself would not transform people. We don't need a map. We need ways to change the map maker. He calls for practice that exercises physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual waves. Those are those 4 functions of the mind of Jung and the 4 parts of that commandment, those 4 things. We need to find a way to exercise those 4 functions. I'm trying to find myself here. Oh, in self, culture, and nature. These are these 4 quadrants that he has there. Culture and actually includes, or is it nature includes 2? Which one is it, John? Nature includes 2 of those quadrants. I guess the 2 right ones? Okay, good. I'm right on time. Regarding the self, he suggests such practices as physical exercises, such as weightlifting, diet, jogging, yoga, emotional exercises like Qigong, counseling, psychotherapy, mental exercises, mental exercises such as affirmation and visualization, and spiritual exercise such as meditation and contemplative prayer. Moving to culture, he suggests getting involved in community service of varying kinds and making use of mutual, respectful dialogue and relationships in general to further our own growth and the growth of others. In the area of nature, Wilber suggests getting involved in activities which respect nature, such as recycling, environmental protection, and nature celebration. Activities which both honor nature and promote our own capacity to care. Regarding the importance of meditation, he says, it has been shown that meditation increases the percentage of the population who are at second tier, or in other words, higher levels of this area, from less than 2% to an astonishing 38%. So he strongly recommends that we learn this practice or use this practice of growing and developing as individuals. And I hope that you have seen the relationship between what Ken Wilber has had to say and what Carl Jung has had to say and his philosophy with these particular scriptures. I hope that that has come a little bit clear to you. I'd like to share with you, before we do a little exercise, a couple more quotes. This from Joseph Smith. "The things of God are of deep import, and time and experience and careful and ponderous and solemn thought can only find them out." Four things, that's interesting. "Thy mind, O man, if thou wilt lead a soul unto salvation, must stretch as high as the utmost heavens and search into and contemplate the darkest abyss and the broad expanse of eternity. Thou must commune with God." We could draw some parallels with this chart of going into the depths, the very origin of our existence. We're going way out into the heights of developing a more holistic, integral abilities and attitudes. I think that we could again draw some parallels in those to Joseph Smith in this area. Idris Shah says this: "The Sufis claim that a certain kind of mental and other activity can produce, under special conditions and with particular efforts, what is termed a higher working of the mind, leading to special perceptions whose apparatus is latent in the ordinary man. Not surprisingly, in consequence, the word Sufi has been linked by some with the Greek word for divine wisdom, Sophia." Shah also quotes a Sufi proverb: "He best honors God who makes his intellect as like God as possible." At this point, you may be wondering, so what, for one thing? And so what do I do next, for another? Let's do another exercise to close. I'd like each of you to close your eyes. Take a deep breath and relax. Contemplate something peaceful. Empty your mind of other thoughts. And I'd like you to address that part of your mind that you would call, that I would call, the psyche. Whether it's the inner spirit, your divine nature, big mind, whatever you are comfortable calling this part of your mind, close your eyes and ask a question to this part of your mind. What would you have me do next to become more like God? That is all. Now, I submit to you that in many cases, your psyche will respond. Your inner nature will respond. The spirit will respond. Your divine nature will respond. Whatever you may call it or feel that it is, it will respond to you, and you will get a response. If you'd like to share that response, I do have some handouts up here on the table. My email address is on there. You can certainly feel free to talk to me about it. It also gives you some ideas of how you might go about working with your psyche. There are several books in the Jungian area and several of Ken Wilber's books on this particular handout. So feel free to pick that up and use that. Some of you may not have been comfortable in addressing your psyche or the inner part of your mind. Some of you may not get an immediate answer. If that is the case, then that is what is right for you. That is fine. Do not be distressed. You're not ready. For some reason, your psyche is not ready to disclose what it will disclose. The time will come when you will be ready and the psyche will respond. Until then, God help you all. Amen.
why am I here and what's my relevant background? It's kind of random. Sunstone asked me to be a respondent on some things, and I looked it over and I found five or six titles of where the titles seemed interesting, and I sent it to them, and they picked a couple, and here I am. No specific expertise in Jung or Wilbur. However, I'm a sociologist by background. I taught social psychology and social theory at places like Boston University and Rice University and Cornell. And I thought a lot about the development of self, and I published a few things on such things and did some training for a while and such things. Taught theories related to the development of self and mind and so on. Could you put that back to the picture that had the diagonals? Pardon?
The diagonals.
It was the last one on the screen.
The one I didn't get to?
No, the last one that was on the screen.
Oh, okay.
In any case, well, the three of those quadrants I can have claimed some expertise in. And the fourth one my son does, who's studying philosophy of mind as a graduate student at Harvard, and we've had long discussions about these. I wouldn't say we've reached common ground. I also have an interest in religions. I'm chairman of Area Congregations Together in Ithaca. It's got two dozen primary congregations that work together in various ways, and I've promoted interfaith understanding with multi-faith presentations about themselves, so and Cornell United Religious work. So combining some social psychology and religion and philosophy are of interest to me. What most interested me was the title involving basically knowledge and limits to knowledge. And I thought, aha, I can talk about epistemology a little bit and the social construction of reality and such things. But in what was sent me in looking at things, I don't see a lot. I mean, I could make a connection and talk, but I don't have that much time. So let me try and address a little bit more specifically what we find here. I do have to ask, let me first appreciate one thing, and that is I like people who seek integration from various perspectives, religious, social science, and otherwise, and who seek to know and to understand ourselves. But I have to ask the question, two questions. One with regard to the title, what's the connection between the title and the content? And what's the main point? Is it psychology? Is it theology? Is it a path to becoming more godlike? And I don't know which of those it is. It doesn't appear to be theology, even though it's in a setting which is supposed to be about Mormon studies and connecting whatever it is that might be out there to Mormon studies. One can see a potential path in becoming more godlike, but it remains to be developed. In terms of a theology, one would have to also provide developmental connections to Mormon doctrine in various, in much more elaborate ways. The quote from Joseph Smith, "Thy mind, O man," etc., is a wonderful quote. But how do you link that? How do you develop an argument? What is the proposition? What is the conclusion? What's the theory that gets you there? How do you get from X to Y to Z, with X being Jung and Wilbur, and Y perhaps being the scriptures, and Z being a new contribution to understanding? It's not clear to me. And if I use grandiose theories, and Wilbur's theory of everything reminds me of the current thing in physics, it's called string theory and M theory, its latest variation. a theory of everything, and that it's going nowhere. In 20 years, it has not produced, even though it's the hottest field in physics, 20 years it hasn't produced a single unique prediction that's testable. And so as we develop an idea, we have to be able to ground it. Where does it come from? What is the kind of evidence? How does it link? And that, are the links the kind that take us to where we want to go? And so we have to define where we want to go, and it's not clear where we want to go. And if we look at, you know, as a social psychologist with an empirical bent, and having looked at a lot of these kinds of developmental stages and categories and so on, there isn't a lot of support for those kinds of things. They don't prove to be very useful in personality theory or development of self theory. They may look nice and have feel good, but do they help us? And how do we get from one stage to another? How do we demonstrate that they're rooted in some kind of empirical reality or in some strong theory? And how? What are the mechanisms that can take us from one to another? How do we become self-actualizing, if we want to use another prominent social psychologist term, in a godly way? What is it that God must be like? Well, notice the form of that question. What must God be like? That is a bad way to pose it, because we don't know what God must be like. And there's lots of speculation about the nature of God. And people say, well, God is like this and God is like that. And you ask them why. Well, he must be, because he loves. Well, does love mean the same thing to him as it does to us? Does the mind of God and the mind of man coincide? And if so, into what degree? So we make speculations, and we do so with very little grounding, either in Scripture or in something that we can call empirical that has an eternal path to it. That is, we can say, this is the consequence that it will have in eternity. So that's another path that needs development. If we're to make this useful as someone who aspires to be godlike through the path of Christ, how do we connect them? We can think about, you know, when we think about limits of knowledge, we can think about theory of deception. Prominent philosopher of science named C. West Churchman, clear back in the 1960s, argued that the best thing science can do is to develop a theory of deception. How we deceive ourselves, how we create grand schemes that don't actually get us to where we want to go. They're appealing, but they often represent, I guess, kind of Yogi Berra's thing, when you come to a path in a road, take it, or what is a fork in a road, take it. Well, which is the correct fork? And we need a rationale. We need a theory that says this is a good path. What is the argument for that? We need that to be developed. So those are some of the kinds of things I'd point at that would strengthen this kind of approach to things. Rootedness in empirical reality, rootedness in a gospel reality, links to what we do know about God while being humble about what we don't know and leaving it open to see what we can develop. Taking an experimental attitude, being willing to try some things, but being willing to recognize that even when it might feel good, it might have not, its long-term consequence may not be the right one, even if it feels good in the short run. And it gets very complicated. So I guess I'm urging humility about all grandiose schemes of theology and psychology and linking them together. Being humble to say, we don't really know what God is like. We don't know what love and many other things may mean to him. We know what he asks us to do. He doesn't require that we believe and know very much. He requires that we do certain things. So where does the doing fit in various schemes? What is it we must do, and how do those doings get us to a goal that's still somewhat vague, but has a distinct concept associated with it, and that is being like God, which means in some degree thinking, feeling, behaving, seeing, etc., like Him. So those are paths to develop further in this approach to life.
Thank you, Alan. I think that was a noble effort and a good academic critique for someone who doesn't know the content of the topic matter that was presented, I think, and with regard to Jung and Wilbur. To put that critique in perspective, I believe. Are there any questions or comments from the audience?
You didn't identify the woman's picture of the mind of God.
Sure. No, I didn't. I didn't have the time to do it, so I skipped that part. We'll take just a quick look at it here. This is basically the same diagram, but now done like a plate of spaghetti, okay, where everything is kind of mixed together. In Ezekiel, it talks about these four creatures and these four faces, and it says they're like a wheel. And it's like a wheel within a wheel, and wherever the one wheel goes, the other wheel goes. And so I took this and said, well, can we diagram this as maybe a rudimentary look at the mind of God? And said, here are those four mental functions of heart, might, mind, and strength operating in the four areas of reality. And we could let these things spin and let them turn. And we're really, as individuals, functioning in all these areas at once, experiencing all these types of mental things in a stream. Kind of like a woman sees a plate of spaghetti. Everything is connected together and spins around together. And if that doesn't confuse you, we've got other things we can show you. I'm going to take just a minute to respond to the respondent on a couple of questions or points he brought up. What is the point of this instruction? As a Jungian, if you don't know the point, I have done a very good job. The whole concept of Jungian theory has to do with the standpoint of let your mind expand, give up the idea of a path from here to there. There are no points that are important. It is awareness, it is understanding, it is insight that we lack, especially as Westerners, and that we need to develop. We need a rationale, an argument, an empirical reality. Again, very anathema to the thinking of someone looking at the discipline of whole-mindedness. Certainly we need to be grounded. Certainly we need to function in reality effectively, carefully. And I have gotten involved in this stuff and gotten really excited with it, and I've literally felt the psyche push me back into the real world. Do your job at home. Be a father. Get your job done as a financial planner. Don't get too involved in this. Let this be a tool to develop your sensitivities, your awareness. So in one respect, Alan, no. Okay? Empirical reality is anathema to a lot of what we're saying. In the other standpoint, amen. It's all got to be based in empirical reality, and it has to be effective and do something for us, or it does no good. But we don't know what God is like. We have a perfect knowledge of God. Millions of years, I don't know how many centuries and eons we have, but we have a perfect recollection of Him. We just don't remember it. It's just not available to our conscious mind all the time and in total. If it was, we'd go insane. Okay? But a little bit of it can be revealed to us as we are ready. What path should we take? Each of us has an individual path. Pay attention to what the spirit, to what the psyche tells you your path is. You're going to have to go to a social psychologist for a more definitive, a more structured answer than that. I can't do it. Thank you. Any other questions?
Or comments? Dr. Smith.
Just a comment, first of all, about your question about empirical grounding. I think that being familiar with Wilbur's work, it is very empirically grounded on those developmental levels. Sociological development, intellectual development, spiritual development, there's a lot of study that has gone into that. My particular, in terms of practical application, my particular field is in helping people with stress-related medical problems. And I'll tell you, when you start getting into this deep self, you find people have their solutions within them. That once they get into that, the solutions to all these stress problems just emerge, and then you give them tools to work with it. And it does work in very practical ways. And it's often spiritual experience.
Now, one quick comment. We saw Wilbur in kind of a drive-by glimpse, and there's so much more to him. And again, it's something that can be awful foreign to someone who's not familiar with the discipline.
Wilbur's one of my heroes. He's a phenomenon. As a, the developmental fellow at Harvard calls him a national treasure. But that was, my point was that I had an image come to my mind as the last comments you made, Lou, of the hologram. And, you know, my sense was each of us has within us knowledge innate of everything. And but if you take that hologram and break it up into pieces, that image, let's say the hologram is the image of God. If it's broken up to pieces, the image is all there in every piece, but it's not as clear. And it's when those pieces get together that it gets clearer. So that's, it seems to me, that's what the purpose of the community is, to bring those, each of our individual pieces that have it all in there, together, and then it gets clearer and clearer as we have more and more dialogue.
I agree 100%, and we can only handle, right now, little tiny pieces and little shards of that as individuals. And we, if we put the whole picture together, like we say, we would not comprehend it. We couldn't comprehend it. So we have to deal with it a shard at a time, and that does make it difficult. I didn't close with one quote, and I'll quickly give you that one. This is from James Hollis, who said, "The I that I know does not know enough to know that it does not know enough. It thinks itself luminescent crystal, when it is mostly grays, mostly vague, oblique shapes, and sometimes stark, opaque obsidian." And I hope that that's what you got from this, is that we have such little knowledge, such little understanding. But as the Sufis say, we do have that latent potential to know God. And I hope we develop along that path. Go ahead.
This last comment.
Well, I'd just like to ask both the presenter and the commentator. I hear no discussion here about, if someone were to ask me, what do I know about God and how do I know it, and how do I know I don't know enough about God, which I think is plain to me, I would say I know the personhood of God because of what I know of Jesus Christ. Could you comment about how Jesus Christ fits into knowing the mind and spirit, body and intellect of God?
Ellen, you have... Good job. Alan, you have any comments?
And just to mention, time frame wise, we're about out of time, so maybe one minute in terms of a response.
Go ahead.
No, I haven't given that much thought.
I think we know only a little bit about Christ. There's much written, but we know very little. All we know is you can find in the New Testament and 3 Nephi, and that's very little.
Well, just in terms of a final summary comment, to me, Lou reflects a person who, you know, searches broadly and tries to put those tentacles together to sort of get a sense of that that great undivided whole. And Alan brought the voice of intellectual and academic rigor in actually working something out. So I think it was a nice balance of a presentation. And thank you so much for coming.